This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.
Okay, it's Jibs here from Pints of Malt. So our podcast is basically a group of Irish Nigerian lads who tell their stories, growing up in Ireland as well as Nigeria. And we share our experiences with all of y'all. We also add a bit of comedy as well, you know, to get y'all laughing, get y'all through the week in these tough times that we are in. So y'all sit back and just, you know, enjoy the show.
As Jib said, we're the Pints of Malt podcast. You can find us on all streaming platforms, including the Head Stuff Network.
Hello, everybody, and you're welcome to another episode of FNI Rap Chat on the Head Stuff Podcast Network. Head Stuff Plus, thanks so much to our sponsors, Film Equipment Store, Octavid.com, and the awesome Wildcard Distribution, always supporting what we do and pushing us forward and criticising us and all those wonderful things you need to happen to get things moving. So thanks a million for that. Today, I'm really excited by this one. It's a story that I've been following and charting for a couple of years, and I'm just really excited to see something happen with this project. It's a short documentary, a taster, if you will, for a longer, exciting journey that's about to come upon us down the line. It's a short doc that's screening in Galway this year at the wonderfully multifaceted Galway Film FLA this year. This multimedia festival that they've orchestrated this year. It's nothing to declare.
I don't think kids nowadays would be able to do something like what we've done.
People keep asking me this story over and over and over.
I stowed away on a plane as a child with a friend of mine in 1985 to America.
I'm joined by Garrett Daly. How are you doing?
How are you, Paul? How are you?
I'm good, good, very good. I'm, you know, probably warmer than I've ever been in this country right now.
But likewise.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's as warm, or at least it feels to me as if it was when I was in South America a few years ago. How are things in the lofty Sligo?
Yeah, we're on holidays in Sligo and it's absolutely baking outside. I have the curtains closed here to keep the light out just to try and dampen down some of the temperature. It's amazing. And it's beautiful blue seas and it's very busy and it's great to see, particularly after the year and a half that we've all had. I think everybody's sort of just enjoying having something nice to be by the coast and do something different. And I say
absolutely,
all over Ireland, people are doing the
same. It's very much a case of, you know, never neglect the little things of life after all this, right?
Yeah, completely.
So how have you been? Good?
Yeah, good. I mean, I suppose like everybody kind of through lockdown was an interesting period in terms of seeing how where you were going with things or what you were doing. We had a bit of momentum with a project and then obviously it all sort of fell off because obviously everybody stopped, couldn't travel anymore. That was a bit of a bother. But on the plus side, like everybody, that sort of time at home was excellent. You know, I would lecture as well and that had to revert to online lecturing, which was really tough. We got used to it after a while, but I felt really sorry for the students because, you know, I was working with fourth year students who were doing their video projects. That's your main year. I mean, that's the year that you want to make your piece before you head out into the world and make great films. And suddenly the rug was pulled from underneath them. And I thought that was bad in March 2020, but obviously I've just gone through an entire year now with a year again who never got to be on campus, never got to do anything. And they had to revert to shooting everything you know, with phones or cameras that they had themselves, and we would edit across Zoom and yeah, basically just use the technology to try and tell stories, which they did in fairness to them. But I just felt sorry for them because that connectivity of everyone being in a room and sparking ideas off each other was gone. And, you know, that's not they'll never get that back. They'll never get back that year. So my heart went out to them. But on the same side, they still delivered films and they still got on with it. And I suppose that will stand to them in years in terms of when they go forward. They'll look back and go, do you remember that year? Do you remember that year when we had to do everything online?
Remember we had that Dogma 95 experience where we just made it any which way we could in any capacity. Look, you have to admire that kind of graft and, you know, adaptability to be creative under those extreme circumstances. You know, it's a war, almost war-esque environment. They're still out making and being creative. Yeah, I mean, everybody, you know, not just obviously students who you have a great deal of sympathy for because they're kind of robbed of the experience, but anybody making anything during the last year and a half deserves to be commended. Which brings me nicely to your film, which you made largely over the last year and a half, right?
Yes. So, yeah, and this obviously was made as well in sort of tough times. And it's difficult to shoot. I mean, this was a small enough project and we kept it small for that reason. But I, you know, could only imagine what it's like to do something bigger and trying to run the discipline of keeping everything in control and having something major to think about, such as, you know, keeping a COVID-free set. So for us, it was okay. I mean, we had to do a sort of a long form day of interviews and then basically, you know, cutaways, filming and all of that. But even that, even those simple things just required testing. It required travel in particular ways, people not sharing cars, just very simple things. And we're doing a, you know, a documentary where we just want to put some people in a room and do interviews with them. Now, I kept the crew. I'm kind of lucky in that, you know, that I'm able to shoot stuff myself. So that was very helpful because it meant I could keep the crew down. But at the same time, you don't like that pressure. You don't like the pressure of sort of, you know, reducing roles just so you could have less people on set, because it's very easy that something can go wrong. You know, you miss something or you're concentrated on something else. But in this case, it worked out fine. But thankfully, like, we were able to keep it small enough. And small works as well for documentary because, you know, if you want intimate interviews and if you want the subjects to trust you, and if you've been working with them for a number of years anyway, the dynamic doesn't change. And that was good because it's just me in the room with them.
I have to say, like, they seemed really relaxed and they really opened up and they were just like buzzing. And like, I laughed several times just watching them. And like, as someone who's made a little bit of documentary content over the years, it's very hard to snake charm, you know, a natural conversation out of somebody when, you know, when you're talking about anything personal, you know. But yeah, I was so impressed by them. I was giggling several times just with their honesty and you know, courage to just.
That's one of the things I kind of wanted to see. Could I explore that spark that existed between them when they were 10 and 13 and when they went to America that time? And I kind of thought if I could even just get a small window into that. I mean, their lives have been very different since. They drifted apart many years ago. But if we could just sort of showcase in some way that charm, that humor and that chancer nature that was there. If we could showcase that in any way, then I thought that would be a great thing to do. And I suppose I've had the benefit of working with them in a different context over the last couple of years as we've been developing a feature film. And so I got to know them well. And, you know, there's a lot of trust involved, obviously, when you go down a route of a documentary and someone, you know, telling parts of their life and intimate parts as well in terms of, you know, where some of the story goes, that they want to believe that they feel comfortable opening up like that. You don't know sometimes. I mean, as you say, you've done documentary before, Paul. You like any film shoot, even if it's fiction, you build up and you build up and you have all this pre-production. And then it comes down to this moment where you're in a room and you're asking someone questions and you got to hope that it works. And okay, maybe in documentary, you can revisit it if it doesn't work out, if the interview isn't great. You're not at risk of sort of saying, well, we can't afford to go do it again. You have to be able to work with the guests to see will they sit and do the interview again and hope that it maybe goes better. Now, in this case, it went fine, But you are kind of putting everything on the line to hope that that mood is correct and then that it works and you get what you dreamed of.
You know, and I'll say this to you because I know you, you know, well, I was worried. I mean this in a positive way, I was like, okay, you know, I'm kind of familiar with the history of this story a little bit. And I was a bit worried about the idea of, you know, it seizing up and the tension of it, you know, kind of not doing justice to this wonderful, you know, story. And not, you know, in no way is that, you know, aimed at you or anything or any filmmaker that was making this. I was just worried about it not working. But I think guys, I have to say it's excellent. Just to our audience listening, it's an excellent documentary that would absolutely wet your cinematic whistle for whatever's going to happen with it down the line. But it's a lovely marriage of, you know, archive as well, and I think it's used really well, and that must have cost you a fortune, but it's amazing. It's the most entertaining half an hour. I was like, you know, more often than not you're sent screeners, and sometimes, you know, anybody who watches any movies, you know, sometimes you like stuff, sometimes you don't like stuff, sometimes you have to watch it and you don't feel like watching anything, and you know, and occasionally something comes along and it really lifts you out of, you know, whatever mood you're in right there. And that's a brilliant example of the magic of what documentary and cinema in general can do. So I have to applaud you. It's really fantastic.
Thank you, Paul. That's very kind. Lovely words to hear. And I suppose that's the thing. You know, I stood back from this. I've been with it for a number of years as a project, and when you're trying to decide, and when you do go, okay, I'm going to do this, you have to stand back and say, how am I going to do it? You try and figure that part out, and you kind of think, what's the best way to tell it? How am I going to tell this story? I love the notion of them telling us the story in terms of, you know, the sort of direct to camera approach, that it feels like they're taking us on this journey. And yeah, how do you showcase something that was never documented? I mean, that was, you know, that's a tough challenge with any documentary. So you kind of lean into an approach, and then I think you just have to go with it and you know, create an 80s vibe in it, or, you know, lean into the archive. I mean, that was an incredible search to try and do that. And yes, you're right, quite expensive. An eye-opener in terms of what some of those things can cost, you know, and approaching big organizations as well for tiny little clips for different things. And you just go, that's not going to happen. But yeah, just trying to find a way. And I was really, really, really adamant of trying to create a crowd-pleasing film, because I was conscious of where we've all been. This story comes with its own baggage, and that a lot of people know it. So I kind of thought as well, I want people to be able to enjoy this and to smile and to really just get into a zone with these two as they tell us the story. You may be familiar with it, but now here they are telling it, and they're telling it in a very entertaining way that I hope will have people smile, entertain, and just bring them along on this journey for a bit of fun over the half hour.
And that absolutely captures that. I mean, it's like the most outlandish bar conversation you've ever had. Entertaining bar conversation with someone at a bar counter, and then finding out afterwards it's true.
And you know, there's a beer dedicated to these two. A brewery brought out a beer. Yes, there is. There is. They wrote to us a while back and said, we have this beer that is dedicated to these two. So, you know, that's the type of thing. I mean, how many stories? There's a song coming out about it as well. So there's just people are fascinated by it. So as you say, it's a great, great story. And I just kind of thought, sit down here and we'll tell you this story. That was the approach.
So how did it come to you initially? I mean, what was the genesis of like, it's obviously it's a couple of different projects, but like, how did the idea come to you? You obviously got hold of the rights at some point. What inspired you to get to want to tell this story?
I think it was, I had read about it initially. Then I had heard Paul and Ronan's documentary on Radio 1, The Doc on One. And I think as well, when you just automatically assume, sure, there's basically, that's gone already. I'm sure people have got the rights or have approached them. And it turned out that, yeah, people had approached them, but they didn't sign with anybody. They'd been messed about a bit, as what happens sometimes. And it was really only Keith that had been approached. Keith had been in the documentary, and I kind of thought, no, that doesn't seem right. We need to find Noel as well. Basically, it's the two of them. It's both their stories. So we searched for Noel because he was a bit off the grid at that stage. He was having trouble in his life. But we eventually found him and we brought the two of them to a hotel and sort of sat them down, which was amazing because I hadn't met in years. And I gave them a pitch and I said, this is what I'd love to do. We'd like to make a film. We'd really like to kind of have it set in that time. It's literally this sort of Home Alone on the road type of story. I think they liked us. And they said yes. And basically then we signed with them. We signed up sort of life rights at that stage to basically go and set about developing a screenplay based on. So that's kind of how it began. And from there then I went and hired a writer, Conor Ryan from Limerick. He's a chap I met in Los Angeles, actually. And a great writer, a real comedy writer. So we started work on the script and we developed it all ourselves first. We didn't bring anybody in on this because obviously I wanted to do it sort of carefully. And we developed the script and got the script into good shape with Connor. He did a really brilliant pass on it. And it was at that stage then we approached Screen Ireland with the script for further development. And we got it into further development and started doing, you know, more passes on it. And the script has had great response. It's a really tight script. It's really well told. It's very true to the story. And it's really funny. And all those elements that I suppose we're talking about that are in the documentary are kind of there, except it's from the perspective, obviously, of two kids. It's a 10 and 13-year-old, which straight away makes it a difficult film to finance because you don't have a lead actor or actress that can carry the movie in the same way as you would normally for when you're trying to package it. So that makes it a little bit difficult to finance because it's an expensive movie. It's a period film that travels multiple countries. So as a producer with notions at the beginning, thinking this is a brilliant this is a brilliant story, sure, this is one to make. And like you have to remember as well, we're coming off the back of I think it was 2014, I think, when we got the rights. We're coming off the back of a tiny, small, not brilliantly critically received Irish film that we had kind of, you know, crowdfunded for and made, and it was a period drama. And so our kind of, you know, our CV isn't amazing in terms of taking that big step forward to go and make quite a large budget movie that has to be made outside the normal funding models of, you know, Irish funding. So immediately it's taking me into the world of co-production and it's taking me beyond to look for financiers elsewhere. So we start getting attention from the States as well because it has that sort of transatlantic story. And yeah, and that leads to good and bad, you know, attempts at getting it.
I'm sure you have some war stories about.
Yeah, you do. And you learn, you're learning on the job, unfortunately, as these things happen. But it's in a really, really good place now. We're working with the Kennedy Marshall Company in Los Angeles. We're working with Cornerstone Films in London. And yeah, we have a lot of people interested and we're currently sort of searching for a director. But this, you know, when you go out to somebody or you're waiting, 6 months can drift by just waiting for an answer, for a schedule to clear up or for finance to showcase in certain areas. So it feels like a long process and has done over the couple of years. But I'm very happy to say that it is in a good place and I'm feeling very positive about it, despite any sort of ups and downs behind the scenes that I think probably every project has. And it's probably my first experience of it in terms of it at a sort of bigger, at a bigger scale, because as I said, it's gone outside the country in terms of searching for finance and names to attach to it.
It must be difficult, you know, to cast, or I'm sure you haven't got to that point yet. But again, that the idea of like unknown entities and you'd be planting obviously maybe some names or some Irish actors around that, or, you know, UK actors and, you know, and American actors to try and make it all work and zing. I suppose that its greatest strength and its weakness, biggest weakness, is the kids and their story.
Correct. So, so you're talking about people taking a bit of a punt on something because there is a slight unknown quality to it. I mean, we can all look back on great films that featured kids and go, weren't they brilliant? But they could have easily gone wrong as well. So I suppose dealing with that sort of that nervousness that would surround financiers. And that was part of, I suppose, going to, you know, bringing in people with bigger experience as well, so that it kind of will help people feel a little bit more confident around it, to know that we can put the right people in place to tell this story. Here's hoping, but there's always, you don't know with these projects. I mean, I remember reading about, was it The Favourite? I think it was. Did it take 20 years to get to the screen? And now I don't want that, but you don't know with these things, because so much about timing is, you know, the right place, the right time, people feeling like they want those stories. I've had a few, you know, big organizations circle back round. You get a pass and then it comes back again simply because there's a different person in a job and suddenly they're looking for a different type of movie. So, you know,
it's a bit zeitgeisty, isn't it? I mean, it has to, you know, it's the same even on a smaller level, which, you know, a lot of us circulate. I mean, something that you maybe have worked on and you might have pitched to Screen Ireland, it wasn't the flavour of the month for whatever reason back then. A lot of people lose faith in projects and discard them altogether. Would you have any advice about how to keep kind of a project alive, keep your interest alive? Keep not lose faith, especially if you might have been rejected. And then I'll ask also further to that, how you deal with rejection, because I'm sure you've been rejected like the rest of us over the years.
Oh, it's really tough. So keeping a project alive, I mean, I think you have to return to what you first saw in it and the very thing that attracted you to it in the first place. If you saw its potential, it's so easy to lose sight of that, particularly as conversations happen, positive and negative conversations. You can start drifting it in a direction you may never have wanted. And you have to think very clearly about that. Hang on, is this the film that I want to make? Particularly when conversations start happening around filmmakers that might be, you know, that people think are suited to it. And you might not think, no, that's not the movie I wanted to make. So I think you go back to your original, you know, thought around why were you attracted to it in the first place? Because there's going to be so much.
So it's a bit, I suppose it's like a long-term marriage and, you know, looking at your wife and trying to remember where you fell in love with her in the first place to keep it going.
Exactly. And then in terms of the rejection, Paul, right? That does feel like an abusive relationship at times.
It's where the most dysfunctional relationship.
It's so dysfunctional. Like, you absolutely love what you do. And I love, I'm so thrilled. Like, I get such a buzz at the fact of any time I'm able to tell a story in any shape or manner. But like, the journey there can be brutal. And you, like, the amount of times you ask yourself, why am I doing this? Why am I distracted on this particular day and not even talking to the family properly because my head's spinning from a rejection and I can't understand why? And it can take days for you just to let that percolate before you feel anyways normal again. That's not healthy on you. I think it isn't healthy at times. I think, like, I'm a pretty stable person. I'm fairly stable, but I would definitely say that stuff that has happened in any attempt at media production is the one thing that has rattled me all the time. Yeah, and it's really tough. And you go back to the well, I think. You question, you wonder, and you look in, and then you have to ask yourself, do I want to go on? And that's why I think it leads you back to the project. And I suppose, in a way, you know, having a documentary, I suppose, emerge from what set out to be a feature film originally was a number of things. It was like I wanted to do something productive in the time. Lockdown afforded me that opportunity. I had two people that I'd been working with who were happy to tell their story. One who never had it told before and whose health is up and down. So I kind of thought, if I don't push Noel on camera, just in case, you know.
He was great, by the way. He was really great.
Yeah, and also just that sort of, you know, there is such a world now where, because you worry about it, you worry about putting, you know, one thing out before the other. But the world in which we're in now is like complementary storytelling. Netflix are at it all the time. You see the film and you want to see the doc about the true story people. I watched Halston recently with Ewan McGregor and I was kind of fascinated by the character. And I went and there was a documentary that I didn't know about that had played at Cannes that I found and went and watched that afterwards. So I think you were attracted to this. So it was part of that as well to sort of, you know, use this time to basically tell this part of the story so that there was a visual capture and an access point for people to do it. And I think that's how you turn maybe negativity into a positive thing at times. It was a desperate period for so many people, you know, so much work stopped for people. And we just wanted to do something positive in that time and turn it into something that people could enjoy. It's a good way to tackle rejection or things going on sometimes, if you can. It's not always the case that people can do that, you know, but if you can, you can certainly try.
Yeah, I guess that comes down to having a good team. How important is it to have to support and be supported in what you do, in your work?
Yeah, I mean, it's really important, I think. At different stages in terms of what you're doing, and from the pitching stage to have people interested, from just a core group of people that you like working with, it's really good. And I didn't get to work with as many people as I normally would work with on this, just simply because of the nature of the times that we were in. But yeah, I go back to the same post house. I go back to the same, you know, sound mixing. I go back, you know, to the same crew an awful lot of the time when you work on things, because that trust level is important. You feel insecure a lot of the time because obviously you're unsure of yourself and you doubt yourself at many stages. And it's good to work with people who, you know you as well, because they can help you. And it is a collaborative thing. So you just try and work with smarter people than you a lot of the time to make you look.
It is that thing of, you know, hiring people around you or working with people who, to a degree, are better than you are, you know, and just let them do their job, you know. We might go back, I suppose, to the start of it all and just talk a little bit about how you got into filmmaking in general terms. What was your earliest memory of kind of cinema when you were a kid, or when did you know? Was there a light switch moment when you said, "Oh, okay, I think I'm going to be a filmmaker now"?
We have three brothers and, you know, we loved all those, you know, 80s movies growing up. We were big viewers on these tiny screens at home. but I do kind of remember something where everyone kind of thought I was a bit odd. We had my mum's father, my grandfather, owned an electrical shop in Roscommon, and he would have fixed cameras and stuff like that down through the years. And there was an old, I think it was an old Super 8 camera at home in one of the drawers. And I remember finding it and thought, what's this? And we had no film. I think there were cartridges that took. We know the film cartridges, but we didn't have any of those. It wasn't like it was a camera that was documenting the family as they were growing up. It was just an old camera that just sat there in a drawer. And I found this and I loved the sound of it when I would play, because the motors would still run through it. So it sounded like it was filming something. Yeah, when you do it, and it had this tiny little eyepiece that you look through. I got all my mates out and I said, come on, we're going to make an Indiana Jones film. And I got all of them all dressed up and I got, you know, we made like little props and everything, and we went down the field and, you know, there was this sort of wooded area and I kind of designed the places that they would run through and all of this. And I took the camera and I started filming it with no film and just directing them all to be in this
thing. It's the pantomime of it though, isn't it? And the, you know, the role playing of it.
But there was no... I don't know what age I was when I did that, but I do remember doing it and everyone kind of playing along, because it was just playtime, essentially. But there was no access to kind of, like, I had nobody in the industry, no connections to it whatsoever. And I did not know, sure, how will I ever get to do anything like this? It didn't seem possible, or there was no entry point to it at all. And I suppose it wasn't until, I think I was in, Maybe leaving cert year, I picked up some prospectus sitting in a library on a free class one day in St. Pat's in Navan, and I started seeing these media courses in the UK, and obviously the career guidance teachers just didn't want you to go near anything like that, you know. They were sending me for hotel catering and various different things like that. And I saw this course in England, and I remember going home and I said, like, there's this course in Bournemouth and there's this course in Sunderland. I think I could probably get into them because I knew I didn't have any of the points levels. I was very average for the likes of Dunleary. I didn't have a portfolio anyway. Or going to, I think it was DCU at the time, had like journalism or so, just something close. There was no such thing as kind of major film courses at the time. That's right, yeah. So I saw this one that was very practical in the UK and I sort of set my sights on it. It was kind of a light bulb moment where I said, maybe I could do that. My parents were like, you're going to go to the UK to do this? And I was like, yeah. And I that was it. I kind of knuckled down to try and get, I needed a couple of honours or something to get it. Nothing major, but I sort of set my sights on doing it and I got it. And once you actually got, you didn't have to wait for the points system to come out in the Leaving Cert, because if you got what they set you, you knew you had it. So the day I opened the Leaving Cert results, I was like, I've done it. I've got it. I'm going to the UK to do this at 18. And then I felt like, okay, now this is a chance. I'm going to get to try and I loved it. It was like, here we go. I went to Sunderland University to do a sort of media production degree.
Wow. Why I mate? oh, I shouldn't have said that. That's Newcastle. Yeah. And like it must be so incredible to, you know, based on, you know, that role play pantomime scenario when you were a kid, to, you know, to interpret that and then to have meetings with potentially with the person who was on doing that very thing that you were imagining, literally the very thing, standing off to the right. That must have been incredibly surreal. Now, I know you shouldn't hero worship people or whatever, but, you know, you must have had a serious Jesus Christ type thing.
Yeah, pretty surreal. You don't kind of, I mean, because you don't ever imagine that something like that could happen. And sometimes you don't even know how it does happen in terms of, well, right here, this is where we're at. And, you know, I never made that connection in terms of thinking back to when I was doing it. But they were the very things that I was doing was Indiana Jones, because we were mad about that at that age. And yeah, I suppose if you stand back from it, you could just sort of pinch yourself and go, that is absolutely crazy. To even get, as I remember, I said, when that connection started and those conversations started, there was a part of me, because that imposter syndrome, I think that exists. And you think, how the hell do you ever get to tell anything in the first place or do anything? But now to even be in conversation with, you know, people like that who've made amazing movies and movies that we grew up sort of idolizing, you just kind of think, even if it didn't go anywhere else from here, that's a win, because you go, yeah, you know, I've developed something that they like.
It's a validation of your creativity, you know, regardless of the outcome. It's a wonderful validation. I am there, you know, I'm a filmmaker, you know. Because, you know, that imposter syndrome is a regular theme that comes up on the podcast. I don't think anybody ever feels comfortable enough to say that those particular shoes are theirs. You know, it's always, you know, even some people that literally had a you know, rather large film coming out were on with us and talking and saying, you know, I'm promoting this and I was put in for funding last week and, you know, they rejected it. And, you know, I feel like the worst director in the world, you know, that I have zero talent. So it never goes away. How do you deal with that? Like, how do you, in terms of mindfulness and stuff, how do you, from a psychological point of view, do you practice any meditations or just give yourself a break or play golf? Maybe, who knows? What do you do?
Yeah, well, I've started playing golf because my son started playing golf and he's quite good at it and he's had me out. And actually, yeah, it's one of those things. I mean, I was never drawn to that as a sport or wanted to play it. And even just that, because you're out for 3.5 hours playing 18 holes with your son or something and you do switch off. And I never saw the benefit of anything like that coming, you know, in terms of just being able to sort of move away from it. And I think that is important. It's really important. Like, to me, I love it so much. I'm surrounded by it in a way. I work with students when I'm teaching, in terms of helping them with their careers. I love to make stuff. I love to watch stuff. I'm surrounded by it. So if you do get rejection and it comes along, it does get in on you, and it can really, because there's no escape, I feel, particularly if you have surrounded yourself by it. And I suppose if I was to offer any advice, for what it's worth to anybody, is to have some other things to take you away from it, whatever that may be, whether you play tennis, whether you meditate, whether you run, walk, doesn't matter, just something to get your headspace right. Family is a great help as well, because obviously they will draw you into so much other things that, you know, the world of film doesn't matter until they start loving it then, and then they're having conversations to you about,
it's my hobby, it's my thing, it's my thing. Yeah, and obviously stay away from the pub, you know, like the other thing can't be the pub or other
stores. No, definitely not. No, you've got to keep, because, you know, you don't want to be sending angry emails or angry texts based on stuff. And take a beat, actually, as well, because you have to be able to understand the other side of the table as well. You know, you're not getting rejected, you know, for wrong reasons, you would hope. So you've got to analyze that, you've got to look at it. And, you know, I can look back on decisions now and with maturity basically say, yeah, they were right. You know, that project wasn't ready or wasn't good enough, and they were right. I can look at others as well and say they completely missed the boat on that. And you go and see it getting made elsewhere, you see it done in another form, and you think, why? And the why can be for multiple reasons. And I think if you start blaming yourself fully, that's when you will lose confidence and you will begin to forget why you wanted to do it in the first place. It's generally not personal. Sometimes it can be, but you try and just separate yourself from it so that you can actually evaluate and maybe come back stronger, which is really hard to do, but you've got to try and do it. If you want it, you've got to keep persevering to try and get to do it. And that's the toughest part, but any challenge is.
It's a tough pill to swallow, but, you know, it is that, you know, whatever people think of you, good or bad, is none of your business. You've a job to do, you know. It can't be that thing where you think that there are agendas or vendettas or whatever, you know.
I'll say another thing as well. I think you have to be careful what you wish for sometimes.
It can be bigger than you if you get it, right?
Because I remember when we had Nightingale Falling released, and, you know, our sense of achievement was like, we just felt so good. We had done something that we felt, we had a great bunch of people together. It all worked for nothing. It was like this amazing vibe. And then it was like, okay, well, we'll try and get into the cinemas, or we'll try and get it released. And then you do, and then you get slaughtered by critics. Mm. And you're suddenly like pulled right down into this pit where you just want to hide and you don't want to come out. And you're thinking, oh my God.
What did I do?
That feels so different. And then you can't get away from that. And you go from just your own personal sense of absolute happiness and going, we did it, I managed to achieve it, always would love to have made a film, I did, to, oh my God, like, this is unbelievable. They don't like it. They don't like it. They're saying something really nasty about it, something really horrible on social media. And you think, what have I done? Why did I look for this? Why did I go after this? And that's why I say sometimes you just have to be careful what you wish for as well, because you have to be able for that. That's really, really tough. And there's no escaping it. Once you go looking for it, there's no escaping it. And I'm sure that was a small film. I'm sure that has happened to big filmmakers as well, where they've basically, you know, just been surprised by something and hurt by something. Yeah. And you have to build yourself back up again. I mean, that was
I don't understand it, like, in the world of critique, why people have to be so very hard on things. You know, it's, you know, especially if it's an endeavor that might have been made under circumstances which are not the norm. Just generally in life, I don't understand why people in general have to be hard or mean, overtly mean or mean-spirited in order to get her point across. You know, it's crass. It belittles everybody involved, and it's not something that no one wins from that. Like a bad review, 2-star review or whatever, that's fine. If it's not for you, it's not for you. It's the taster menu thing. Send it back if you don't like it, you know, whatever.
The problem is if you approach it and you don't try and flag it as, oh, this is made with no money, you're not looking for that sympathy in the first place. You're hoping it's judged on its merits as a film. And so the reviewer will judge it on that. And if they do think it's awful, they will write about it being awful. It's you that gets hurt. And they just feel, I mean, I don't think we had anything too nasty in terms of, there might have been one or two. And they really sting, particularly if they're nasty, like, and they do cross a line. But generally, no, I mean, they have a job to do as well in terms of, you know, advising people. But I suppose you don't see it coming. That's the thing. And yeah, it's the last thing you imagine. I can tell you, there was a bad weekend. I remember as one newspaper came out after another, you're thinking, I don't want to read anymore. I don't want to see anymore. What can I do to get away from this? And here you are celebrating something as well, particularly at that level.
It should be celebrated. And, you know, I know it's cliche to say that, you know, making the film is getting it finished and getting it out there is, you know, an achievement in itself. But it really is in those circumstances. I mean, you have to obviously, you know, and I'm sure a lot of people have, and I know for a fact 4 or 5 of my friends who are in a very similar position where they got a feature over the line, they got it done, got a little bit of funding in whatever capacity they got it. And then they just cringe by the gut punches that they got in different ways, whether it be, you know, not getting it distributed or, you know, or it being poorly reviewed or whatever it was. I mean, it is a success for what it was at that time. And you have to bounce back ability is hugely important. Like even in what you're doing, that we talked about notions or that idea of courage. It's courage. You need great courage to be a filmmaker. Because you literally are, you know, putting a public persona out there, and it's very easily attacked, you know, and it's no reflection of anybody's personality. And that's the worst part about it. It's like, you know, a lot of people take, you know, make very personal, infer some personal things. And it's really unfair, you know.
You have to take those little wins as well, those little moments that really mean something to you as a crew, as a cast, as the people that have done stuff. And, you know, whether that is, if you feel that maybe getting an IFTA nomination is a validation, and then go and enjoy it and be in the room with some of these people you really admire and take that, those little things that you never thought you would do. Mm-hmm. Or I remember one moment, and it wasn't long actually after all those reviews had come out, and all I wanted to do was never have that film mentioned to me ever again. And I was flying to the States on Aer Lingus.
Yeah.
And a person sitting beside me started watching the film.
Oh no.
On the screen. And then people around, about 5 people at the same time, were all watching the movie. And you know what went through my mind at that point was, at what stage will they turn it off? That's how I was feeling about it. And so all I was watching was to see when will they stop watching the movie. That's a terrible thing. And people said, did you not say to the person, you know, oh, I actually made that film? And I thought, no way, I did not.
That was just,
but that's a win
that
in
was
the
just
same
a
time.
Very, very unfortunate time, and more so than anything else. Because they you know, there's all sorts of reasoning as to why people don't like stuff, taste-wise or otherwise. You know, people rave about stuff and it's not to my taste and vice versa. You know, it's that opinion. Everybody, you know, everybody has an opinion like they have arseholes thing. And some people will like things for different reasons. But bounce back ability, very, very, very important. And you're a shining example of that, of going after the next thing, creating an opportunity. And I have to say, fair play, and I can't wait to see what happens next. How long does the short doc is available on the Flower website? How long is it up there for people to watch?
I think it's only up there for the Sunday, the 25th of July.
Okay.
And then I suppose what we'll do is we'll travel to festivals after that, hopefully.
Okay.
You know, I'd be hoping to try and get it into all the Irish festivals, if possible, do a good run of that. And then obviously international as well. I'd be hoping that the story can translate. It'd be nice to get somewhere in the States to premiere and see. Yeah, I'd be kind of just hoping that it'll eventually, you know, work its way around and find that audience. I do like film festivals. I like I've had stuff that I've made sort of directly to go to TV, if for want of a better description, you know, in documentaries, and you get a huge audience on one night if you're lucky, and it goes out. And obviously nowadays you'll obviously get a social media hit at the time when it goes out, whether people like it or not when it goes out, but it's great, it reaches a wide audience. But actually it's over really quickly for something mm-hmm. you've really experienced. And it probably goes back to the small wins. I'm actually really looking forward to actually just having a film go round to different places, because I love going round to them. I love meeting the people at them. There's that interaction. And you talk about, I think really now we're looking forward to stuff like that, because the festivals offer you that opportunity. So in a way, it kind of prolongs the life of the film. You know, rather than, you know, making it as a straight for TV documentary, which it could easily have been as well. But I really wanted it to play in on screens and have an audience interaction.
It's so cinematic. And let me tell you, just in terms of positive reinforcement, I mean, based on what you were saying about that Aer Lingus experience to what you'll witness when you see it with an audience, that's a win, you know. That's a balancing of the scales, and you deserve that. It's a wonderful piece of work, ladies and gents. It's available on the Galway Film Flower website until Sunday, and it is a wonderful feel good documentary. It's called Nothing to Declare, and yeah, it's absolutely wonderful. Gareth Daly, thanks so much for joining me today.
Paul, it was an absolute pleasure. Thanks.
Keep fighting the good fight. I can't wait to see what happens next.
We'll see. We'll board the plane anyway.
Look, it's going to stow away to festivals all over the world, obviously. Thanks so much and have a great day, mate. Thanks.
Take care. Bye.
Bye, bye, bye.
This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network, a hub for the creative and the curious. Shows are produced in association with Head Stuff and the Podcast Studios Dublin. Find out more or become a member at headstuffpodcasts.com.